Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of Global Financial Investment Services, LLP, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Any investments based on Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Richard Martin, your host, and it's Monday, the 15th of December, 2014. Well, the Bureau of Labor Statistics reported 321,000 jobs added in November, and the unemployment rate at 5.8%. Jobs are plentiful based upon these statistics. A skeptical, critical thinking individual might ask a few questions or point out a few inconvenient facts. The government purveyors of propaganda might not want us to ponder. The non-manipulated, non-seasonally adjusted number of jobs in November fell by 270,000. The Bureau of Labor Statistics added 600,000 jobs as an adjustment to achieve the headline-grabbing result. If the jobs market is so good, why is the labor participation rate at a 30-year low of 62.8%? Since 2007, the number of working-age Americans has risen by 17 million, while the number of employed has risen by less than 1 million. But the unemployment rate is about the same. Why would almost 14 million working-age Americans leave the labor force since 2007 if the economy is booming and jobs plentiful, with 1.2 million leaving in the last 12 months? Why would payroll tax receipts be flat with last year if millions of new jobs have been created? If the country has really added 8 million jobs since 2010, how could real median household income fall by 2.3%? According to the government-reported figures, the economy hasn't been this strong since 2007. GDP has supposedly grown at greater than 4% over the last two quarters. Everyone knows that consumer spending accounts for 68% of GDP. Capital investments that lead to long-term prosperity continue to decline as a percentage of GDP from 20% in 2000 to 16% today. We've chosen consumption and financialization over savings and investment. So, here's what needs to be asked at this point. If GDP has actually grown by 20% since 2008, how does this correlate with a 6.9% decline in real median household income? GDP has been goosed by a $69 billion increase in government spending, with the majority going to the military-industrial complex. ISIS has been a godsend for U.S. GDP and arms dealer profits. GDP was increased retroactively by $500 billion last year based on a new way the government accounts for intangibles. The surge in consumer expenditures over the last two quarters has been in the purchase of services. The higher costs for Obamacare are a boon to GDP. They're certainly not a boon for your bank account. The trade deficit has fallen as exports of petroleum products have temporarily provided a boost to GDP. The collapse in oil prices will reverse that trend rapidly. According to the quasi-governmental mouthpieces at the conference board, consumer confidence is near a five-year high, reflecting what should be robust spending. So we're told by the representatives of corporatism that we are confident about the economy and the future. How does that measure up to the facts on the ground? Black Friday weekend sales collapsed by 11% versus the previous year. As the pundits tried to blame it on online sales, 10% of total retail sales, Cyber Monday also proved to be a dud. If the average person is confident about the future and happy with their economic circumstances, why did they just vote to throw out the bums in November? If consumers are confident, why have real retail sales, excluding subprime debt, goosed auto sales, been flat for the last 3 months and up only 1% in the last year? If consumers are so confident, why are credit card balances still $138 billion below where they were in 2008? If all these new jobs are being created, why is credit card debt lower than it was in mid-2010? Maybe consumers are so desperate they're using credit cards again to pay utility and tax bill and not using them for frivolous Chinese crap at big box retailers. The increased spending at grocery stores and restaurants is driven by food inflation, not food traffic. Discretionary spending at furniture, electronics, and sporting goods stores is flat. Department store sales continue to fall. Sears and JCPenney teeter on the verge of bankruptcy. Deniers is liquidating and Radio Shack isn't far behind. The major chains have completely stopped building new stores. The great bricks and mortar unwind relentlessly plods forward. In addition, online growth is stalling as states implement sales taxes. According to the government, the deficit was only $483 billion in 2014. This is a real doozy. Obama has been touting how he has cut the deficit through his wise management of the budget. This is where government accounting is used by apparatchiks to mislead the public and obscure the truth. A few pertinent facts are always left out by the politicians touting deficit reduction. Because of the budget impasse in 2013, the federal government stopped updating the national debt on a daily basis. But we know from when they started counting again, the debt went up by $2.3 billion per day. Therefore, the national debt on October 1st, 2013, was approximately $17,038 trillion. On October 1st, 2014, the national debt was $17,875. Therefore, the national debt went up by $837 billion in 2014. Just a smidge higher than the reported deficit of $483 billion. Interest is not paid on reported deficits. It's paid on the national debt. So the massaged, manipulated, and made over deficit is meaningless. The national debt was always slightly higher than reported deficits, but in the past few years, the deviation has grown to a Grand Canyon size. The deficit number has been artificially lowered by nothing other than accounting entry hocus pocus. The Federal Reserve increasing its balance sheet to $4 trillion out of thin air creates approximately $80 billion of phantom interest profits that are paid to the Treasury. Why don't they increase their balance sheet to $40 trillion and eliminate deficits altogether? The biggest accounting scam is Fannie and Freddie. Just as the Wall Street banks have created fake profits through accounting entries regarding future losses, Fannie and Freddie have gone the extra mile in helping fake deficit reduction. These bloated, insolvent, government-run pigs required a $187 billion taxpayer bailout in 2009. Amazingly, when you allow criminals to value their assets at whatever they choose, phantom profits flow like honey. These two horribly run institutions of fraud generated profits of $129 billion in 2014, which were paid back to the Treasury. That is four times more than Apple or Exxon's profits during a non-existent housing recovery. Why are their stocks trading at just over $2 per share if they are generating vastly more profits than they were in 2007, when their stocks were north of $70 per share? It's because the profits are fake. Everyone knows it, but the federal deficit is reported $129 billion lower because these insolvent entities pretended to pay the taxpayer back. Accounting entries do not reduce deficits. Spending less than you generate in revenues reduces deficits. According to the government, we've experienced a strong housing recovery since 2010. The supposed housing recovery storyline continues to be beaten like a dead horse by the Wall Street media, that's to say CNBC, and the shills at the NAR. Anyone with a functioning brain, that eliminates CNBC, bimbos, hacks, and Ivy League economists, can see there has been no real housing recovery. The 24% rise in home prices, taken from the Case-Shiller index, since the 2012 low, has been nothing more than a Wall Street hedge fund Federal Reserve scheme to elevate prices and make Wall Street bank balance sheets less insolvent. Wall Street banks withholding foreclosures from the market, while Wall Street hedge funds, Blackstone, use free money from the Fed to buy up housing and rent it out to former homeowners, has enriched the 0.1% while destroying the dream of homeownership for millions. The percent of first-time homebuyers remains near record lows, while speculators, flippers, hedge fund managers, and rich Chinese businessmen make up a record number of purchasers. The fact this is a fake housing recovery is proven by mortgage applications to purchase a home sitting at 1995 levels and 30% below 2009 recession lows. Maybe the fact real median household income is also at 1995 levels. Real wages keep declining, and labor force participation is at 1978 levels, has something to do with real people not being able to purchase a home. Even with the artificial hedge fund demand, existing home sales are lower than 2013 and languishing at 1999 levels. They are still 25% below 2005 levels, despite the lowest mortgage rates in history. New home sales are a disaster, with no appreciable increase in 2 years. Apartment construction has far outpaced single-family housing construction. After a five-year housing recovery, new home sales languish at levels seen at the bottom of the last six recessions. New home sales are 65% below the 2005 peak and at levels seen in the early 1960s, when there were 130 million less people living in the country. According to the corporate media, the auto market is hitting on all cylinders, with annual sales of 16.4 million, the highest since 2006. Pretending to sell automobiles to people without the means to pay you for the automobile is always a good business idea. Of course, when you have Ally Financial and the rest of Wall Street banking cabal doling out 7-year 0% loans and subprime auto loans like candy, it's easy to move inventory. The temporary boost to GDP by issuing more bad debt always works out in the long run, right? If the auto business is booming, why have GM profits fallen from $9.2 billion in 2011 to $5.4 billion in 2013, and on course to fall to $4 billion in 2014? Record levels of channel stuffing produces sales gains, but no profits. Why is their stock 25% below its 52-week high and lower than it was in 2010 when it was IPO'd after being rescued by Obama? If the auto business is booming, why are Ford's profits falling by 35% versus last year and lower than they were in 2010? Why is their stock price 16% below its 52-week high and still 20% below its 2010 price? Auto loan debt is at an all-time high of $950 billion, up 33% since 2010, when the Fed, Wall Street, and the political class in the fetid D.C. swamp decided they needed new debt bubbles in auto loans and student loans to jumpstart the moribund economy. There are 65 million auto loans outstanding, and the average debt now stands at $17,352. Over 30% of auto so-called sales are actually leases. The rest are financed over an average of 65 months. Virtually all new car sales are nothing more than 3 to 7 year rentals. It's amazing what easy money from the Fed can produce. Over 31% of all new auto loans this year were to subprime borrowers. They now account for 36.5% of all outstanding auto loans. You become a subprime borrower by defaulting on previous debt obligations. In a shocking development, auto loan delinquencies surged by 13% in the last quarter, with subprime loan delinquencies skyrocketing by 18%. When has issuing billions of debt to subprime borrowers ever caused problems before? Only a University of Phoenix African Studies major is more of a subprime risk than the millions of ecstatic Escalade drivers cruising around the urban ghetto paradises. The average student loan debt is now $33,000. Until the Obama administration went Keynesian, student loan debt was primarily in the private sector. When Obama entered the White House, total student loan debt was $620 billion, and delinquencies totaled $50 billion. There are now $1.3 trillion of student loans outstanding, with the federal government accounting for $830 billion and guaranteeing a large portion of the rest. Delinquencies have skyrocketed to $125 billion as another taxpayer bailout beckons. According to the corporate mainstream media pundits, the plunge in oil prices from $100 per barrel to $61 per barrel is unequivocally good for the economy. The shale oil boom has worked its magic, and happy times are here again. Sometimes you have to wonder whether the highly educated spokesmodels on the corporate mainstream media are really as vacuous and clueless as they appear, or whether they are just paid to look pretty and mouth the corporate line. They seem incapable of comprehending the unintended consequences of various events. The collapse in oil prices is one of those events. There is no doubt that lower oil prices will lower the price of gas for the average American. Estimates say they will save $368 per year, which can be spent elsewhere. The highly paid shill economists who declare this will boost spending seem to be math challenged. Retail sales figures include gas stations. What isn't spent there will be spent in another category, most likely healthcare or groceries, as prices in both areas continue to escalate. It's a zero-sum game. No new spending will occur. The worldwide supply of oil has only increased marginally over the last few years. The U.S. shale boom has been offset by declines elsewhere. Libya, Iran, Mexico. The reason for the collapse is the same reason for the 2009 collapse. Worldwide demand is contracting. Europe is in a depression. Japan is in a depression. Russia's economy is contracting. China is decelerating rapidly. The U.S. demand is flat. The implications of another global recession after 5 years of central banks printing trillions of fiat currency are alarming, to say the least. The cost to extract shale oil and transport it to a refinery capable of processing it is high. Honest analysts will tell you that a price of $70 to $80 is required to break even. Most companies don't build break even into their plans. Bakken shale oil sells at a discount of about $14 per barrel due to the difficulty of extraction, transport, and processing. It is now selling for $47 per barrel. The number of permits for new rigs fell by 40% in November, when oil was still selling for $75 per barrel. Do you think permits for new wells will fall at a price of $61 per barrel? Capital spending by the energy industry accounted for 33% of all capital spending in the last few years. I'm sure some other industry will pick up the slack, right? It seems the shale oil boom has resulted in a few jobs being created since the 2010 recession trough. In fact, the states where fracking is prevalent have accounted for all the job growth in the nation. I wondered if a shale oil bust will have any employment implications. There are 9.3 million jobs related to the energy industry across the country. The plunge in oil prices created by Saudi Arabia in the 1980s created a depression in Texas, which contributed to the S&L crisis. This plunge will reveal who has been swimming naked in the high-yield bond market and derivatives market. These are just a few examples among a multitude of lies. Others include, stocks aren't overvalued, inflation is good for you, and ISIS terrorists are an imminent threat to your way of life. Every feel-good story fed to the masses by the oligarchs running this sideshow that we call America is no different from the propaganda doled out by other infamous totalitarian regimes throughout history. We believe things because we've been conditioned to believe them. The crony capitalist oligarchs are intelligent enough to invent theories to explain how the world should work, but not intelligent enough to interpret their models correctly. When they act on their theories, Keynesianism, their actions appear to be those of a lunatic. Despite all evidence refuting their theories, their arrogance and hubris lead them to destruction. The collective insanity of this world is almost too much for a rational thinking person to grasp. The extremely wealthy men operating in the shadows will use every means at their disposal to retain power, enhance their wealth, and crush dissent. The two-party system is nothing but a ruse designed to keep the people believing they have a say in how things are run in the country. Both parties support the military-industrial complex. Both parties support the militarization of police forces around the country. Both parties support the mass surveillance of its citizens. Both parties do the bidding of their rich corporate and special interest benefactors. Both parties favor deficit spending for eternity. Both parties believe the government should expand its role in your everyday lives. Both parties do the bidding for and protect the Wall Street interests who really run the country. No more proof is needed than what has occurred over the last 5 years, as criminal Wall Street bankers were rewarded for their malfeasance with trillions of dollars from taxpayers and their puppets at the Federal Reserve. While America was allowing itself to be distracted, amused, entertained, and indebted, the oligarchs were busy conducting a silent coup. All right, ladies and gentlemen, so now it's time for my information, and so here goes. The toll-free number remains at 888-874-4888. Once again, that's our toll-free number, specially for you to call us free of charge, just for the asking, at 888-874-4888. If you would like to write in your emails, please feel free to do so. And my email address is also the same as always at rm@gfawd.com. That's again, RM for Richard Martin at GFAWD, which stands for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design.com. And finally, my direct line for those of you who are interested in calling in to get some information about your personal issues, please feel free to call me anytime, except, of course, during the show, and call 941-441-1682. That is a number in Sarasota, Florida, and it comes straight through to me in Southeast Asia. Again, the number 941-441-1682. Well, I think we've arrived pretty much at our halfway point. Why don't we take a break here, and then I'll be right back. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're back, and hearing Johnny's promo reminds me that I do want to alert you to the fact that there is only about 4 weeks from the beginning of his new seminar coming up in Guatemala, and he's asked me to let you know that you can access information about this. The seminar begins on January the 10th and continues to the 15th in Guatemala. It's very highly recommended by people that I've spoken to as an introduction, a guide, a way to put your toe in the water, if you like, to find out how to emigrate. And ladies and gentlemen, this becomes more and more pressing by the day. If I knew of other such seminars, I assure you, I would let you know about them. I do not. So I do, with all enthusiasm, recommend Johnny. And if you want to know more, please go to www.expatwisdom.com. That's expatwisdom, all one word, .com. And click on the Latin seminar link for sign-up details. So become an expert expat. Go to expatwisdom.com and do go to Johnny's seminar, if you possibly can. Well, I'm sure you're all looking for a stock market comment from me today, and I'm not going to disappoint you. We just witnessed the worst week for global financial markets in 3 years. The collapse of the price of oil is creating panic in financial markets all over the planet. On June the 16th, U.S. oil was trading at a price of $107.52. And since then, it has fallen by $50 in less than 6 months. We are now trading on the March contract at $56.50 a barrel. Well, this has only happened one other time in history. In the summer of 2008, the price of oil utterly collapsed. And we all remember what happened after that. Well, the same patterns that we witnessed back in 2008 are happening again. As the price of oil crashed in 2008, so did prices for a whole host of other commodities, which is also happening again. Once commodities started crashing, the market for junk bonds started to implode. That, ladies and gentlemen, believe it or not, is also happening right now again. Finally, towards the end of 2008, we witnessed a horrifying stock market crash. We could well be on the verge of another major one. Last week was the worst week for the Dow in more than 3 years, and stock markets all over the world are falling heavily right now. Bad financial news continues to roll in from the four corners of the globe on an almost hourly basis. The question really is as to whether we have finally reached that tipping point that I've been warning you about for such a long time. What we witnessed last week is being described as a bloodbath that was truly global in scope. This is how Zero Hedge summarized the carnage, and I quote, "The crude oil index, West Texas Intermediate, second worst week in over 3 years, down 10 of last 11 weeks. Dow's worst week in 3 years. Financials worst week in 2 months. Raw materials worst week since September 2011. The volatility indicator VIX's biggest week since September 2011. Gold's most bullish week in 6 months. Silver's last 2 weeks are the most bullish in 6 months. High yield credit's worst 2 weeks since May 2012. IG credit's worst week in 2 months. 10-year yield's most bullish week since June 2012. U.S. oil rig count worst week in 2 years. The U.S. dollar's worst week since July 2013. The U.S. dollar yen's worst week since June 2013. Portuguese bonds worst week since July 2011. Greek stocks worst week since 1987. The stock market meltdown in Greece is particularly noteworthy. After peaking in March, the Greek stock market is down 40% since then. That includes a 20% implosion in just the past 3 trading days. And it isn't just Greece. Financial markets all over Europe are in turmoil right now. In addition to crashing oil prices, there is also renewed concern about the fundamental ability of the Eurozone to remain stable. Many believe that it is inevitable that it is headed for a breakup. As a result of all this fear, European stocks also had their worst week in over 3 years. European stock markets closed sharply lower on Friday, posting their biggest weekly loss since 2011, as commodity prices continued to fall and shares in oil-related firms came under renewed pressure from the weak price for crude. The pan-European FTS Euro First 300 unofficially ended 2.6% lower, down 5.9% on the week, as the energy sector once again weighed heavily on wider benchmarks, falling over 3%. But despite all the carnage we witnessed in the US and in Europe last week, things are actually far worse for financial markets in the Middle East. Look what happened on the other side of the planet on Sunday. Stock markets in the Persian Gulf got drilled on Sunday as worries about further price declines grew. The Dubai Stock Index fell 7.6% on Sunday, the equivalent of a 1,313-point plunge in the Dow Jones Industrial Average. The Saudi Arabian market fell 3.3%. Overall, Dubai stocks are down a staggering 23% over the last 2 weeks, and fully blown stock market crashes are happening in Qatar and Kuwait too. This is turning out to be a truly global financial panic. Another region to keep an eye on is South America. Argentina is a financial basket case, the Brazilian stock market is tanking big time, and the implied probability of default on Venezuelan debt is now up to 93%. Swaps traders are almost certain that Venezuela will default as the rout in oil prices pressures government finances and sends bond prices to a 16-year low. Benchmark notes due 2027 dropped 43.75 cents on the dollar as of 11:35 a.m. in New York, the lowest since September 1998, as crude extended a bear market decline. The upfront costs of contracts to insure Venezuelan debt against non-payment for 5 years is at 59%, bringing the implied probability of default to 93%, the highest in the world. Recently, Howard Hill mentioned a few things that he looks for to determine whether a major financial crisis is upon us or not. The first condition is a serious market sector correction. According to some participants in the market for energy company bonds and loans, such a correction is already underway and heading towards a meltdown, the second condition. Others are more sanguine, expecting a recovery soon. If the beaten down prices for junk energy bonds doesn't stabilize or recover a bit, we might see the second condition, a spiral of distressed sales of bonds and loans. This could happen if junk bond mutual funds or other large holders sell into an unfriendly market at low prices, and then other holders of those bonds succumb to the pressure of fund redemptions or margin calls and sell at even lower prices. The third condition, which we can't determine directly, would be pressure on credit default swap dealers or hedge funds to make deposits as the prices of the CDS move against them. AIG was taken down when collateral demands were made to support existing CDS agreements, and nobody knew until they were going under. There simply isn't a way to know whether banks or dealers are struggling until the effect is already metastasizing. Well, I'm sure I shall have more for you on Friday, ladies and gentlemen, but that surely is enough to be going on with for now, I should say. All right, let's talk a little more about oil, which has lost 40% of its value in the last few days, and indeed has lost another 5% today alone, down $2.24 a barrel at $56.17 as of right now. A true crash, ladies and gentlemen. What will happen to high-yield energy junk bonds? There are a lot out there, but not much is being added anymore. That market has been largely shut to companies, especially in the shale patch. So it's hard to see how they are going to finance their fracking wages. Research firm Credit Sites predicts the default rate for energy junk bonds will double to 8% next year. Tim Gromatovich, chief investment officer at Peritus Asset Management, had this to say, and I quote, "Anything that becomes a mania ends badly, and this is a mania," end of quote. I think it's obvious that the default rate's going to be a lot more than 8%, don't you? The Fed's grotesque decision to keep benchmark interest rates at record lows for 6 years has encouraged investors to funnel cash into speculative grade securities to generate returns. A report from Moody's this week found that investor protections in corporate debt are at an all-time low, while average yields on junk bonds were recently lower than what investment-grade companies were paying before the credit crisis. Borrowing costs for energy companies have skyrocketed in the past 6 months. Yields on junk-rated energy bonds climbed to a more than five-year high of 9.5% this week from 5.7% in June. When you're as addicted to debt as the shale industry has been, and still would be if they could still get their fix, then seeing prices for your products drop over 40% and the yields on your bonds just about double, just for starters, then you have not a problem, but a disaster. And one that's going to reverberate through all asset markets. It's already by no means just oil that's plunging. Industrial commodities, iron ore, nickel, copper, etc., as a whole, are way down from just a few months ago. I read a nice expression somewhere. The economy is topped with a copper roof, which supposedly means to say that where copper goes, the economy will follow. I see very little to doubt that's what's happening. And the media are way behind the curve in their reporting of what's really going on. WTI and Brent are standards, and standards are one thing. But what oil actually sells for is quite another matter. Many companies and many oil-producing countries, too, must sell at whatever price they can get just to survive. And there is no stronger force in the world to drive prices down. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is today's reality. And while there are many different estimates around about break-even prices for U.S. shale plays, if we go with the ones from Wood Mackenzie, we get at least some idea of how bad the industry is hurting with prices below $60. If prices fall any further, and what's going to stop them because they already are, it would seem that most of the entire shale edifice must of necessity crumble to the ground. And that will cause an absolute earthquake in the financial world because someone supplied the loans the whole thing deals on. An enormous amount of investors have been chasing high yield, including many institutional investors, and they're about to get burnt dreadfully badly. What this all amounts to is that the falling oil price will chase a lot of zombie money out of the markets, the stuff created through a combination of QE-related ultra-low interest rates and money printing, plus the demise of accounting standards that allowed companies to abandon mark-to-market practices. This has led to the record stock market valuation that we see today and that could vanish in the wink of an eye once even just one asset, one commodity, starts being marked to market in defiance of the distortion official policies have imposed upon the global marketplace. We might well be looking at the development of a story much bigger than just oil. I said last week that it would be hard to find a way to bail out the US oil industry, but that's merely one aspect here. Because if oil keeps going the way it has lately, the Fed may instead have to think about bailing out the big Wall Street banks once again. Well, the RIDEX ratio indicator has reached fresh heights of absurdity. Almost 25 times more assets are now invested in bull and sector funds than in bear funds. This is a full 7 times more than at the peak in early 2000. And frankly, at the time, we thought we'd never see such data points again. The recent surge in the bull-bear ratio could only be achieved with sizable inflows. Price gains alone could not possibly explain it. You can safely conclude that everybody was, or rather remains, absolutely certain that the market will rally into year-end and beyond, because that is what it almost always does. Naturally, no one has ever seen the market decline sharply in December, although a few major market peaks have indeed occurred early in December. But even that is rare, not least because the last time it happened was exactly a century ago in 1914. At the time, it was decided to simply close the exchange for a few months instead of risking even more carnage. Meanwhile, that famous war to end all wars, the First World War, which had just begun, was raging, which, of course, as you all know, laid the foundation for another, even bigger war. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is all very bad news indeed, but at least you get to hear it, which, quite frankly, most people, that's to say 99.9% of people on the planet, will absolutely never get to hear. So maybe you're lucky, and maybe it's just not necessary to add all this kind of stuff to your worries and troubles. Well, I just got an email that came right in a few minutes ago from Rodwell Mupambirai, who says, "Hi, Richard. Thanks for a lovely and insightful show. I have a quick question. Given that the federal debt will never be paid back, if Congress instructed the Fed to simply tear up all the Treasury holdings, what would be the implications? Regards, Rodwell." Well, frankly, Rodwell, all the people that I have recommended to buy Treasury bills would be out of their money. There would be no money for them. Thank you very much. So let's hope, Rodwell, that nobody takes your advice, because my fellow listeners will not be very happy with you if they do. No, frankly, this is a zero-sum game. If money gets destroyed somewhere, somebody else loses that same amount of money. So it's all very well to just default on your debts, but somebody is going to have to take the losses. And, of course, in the case of Treasury holdings, that would be all those people that have Treasury bills, Treasury notes, Treasury bonds. All those people will wake up one morning and find themselves without any money in the bank. Or rather, treasury bills, which will shortly become money, or should have shortly become money, when they sold out their treasury bills and took the cash. There won't be any bills to sell out, Rodwell. I'm sure you know that. I'm sure you understand that. And what I'm saying is that this will probably happen at some point down the line, but there will be plenty of warning in advance. And so all of you who have treasury bills are quite okay, because they are the most senior in the line of federal debt, and they will be the last to go. So we'll have plenty of warning that you need to take your money out of treasury bills, get that money into cash, and put it under that proverbial mattress. So please don't worry about it. You will be okay. And treasury bills most certainly are the way to go today. So that's one email. Let's take another email from Ursula Ye, who was having problems accessing the show's archives, where a black bar kept appearing over the play function. And this is what she had to say. Hello, I thank you so much for your response and especially for your suggestions. During trying your suggestion, play in new window, that didn't work, I got an idea that my problem was created by the Fox engine itself. I was right. I accessed your wake-up call from the Internet Explorer. In a moment, I will enjoy your voice of reason, logic, and sanity. Again, thanks so much. I hope you are having a wonderful weekend, and I thank you for your wake-up call. It is a great show. I'm looking forward to many more. Ursula, yay. Well, thank you very much, Ursula, and that's a message. Word to the wise, ladies and gentlemen, if you are having problems with a black bar that's coming across, the chances are you should be... You are probably using Firefox, and you need to go somewhere else, probably to Internet Explorer. So take that as a hint. Hopefully it works. If it doesn't, do let us know, because we want to understand what really is going on in the land of the listeners to the wake-up call. Well, in... As a kind of sequel to Rodwell's email, you've probably heard the latest insane nonsense, frantic voices suggesting that central banks issue free money directly to households. Well, you know, considering that central banks have stolen hundreds of billions of dollars in interest from saver households in the past 6 years, there's a painful irony in these calls for free money to households, now that free money for financiers has failed so catastrophically. A free money giveaway wouldn't actually fix anything. All it would do is to give households the means to pay down a bit of debt or make interest payments on subprime auto loans for another month or two. Free money giveaways are not a substitute for earned income. Debt jubilees won't work either, as all the debt that proponents want to cancel is an asset to somebody else, and often that somebody is a public or private pension fund or another worker's 401k retirement fund. The game's been lost, but central bankers are still on the field wandering around in disbelief that their unspeakable powers to issue money and credit have failed. You can print all the money you want, but it'll never boost wages to keep up with prices. I mean, how obvious is that, ladies and gentlemen? How stupid do you have to be? Well, Thanksgiving weekend spending was down 11%, and movie theater box office no less than 20%. How does a 16-year low Thanksgiving box office and the second installment of The Hunger Games trailing 25% behind the first spell recovery to you? Americans are down and out. They don't have a central banker on their side anymore. Their central banker has sold all she could to the other side, and now she has no choice but to let oil prices kill millions of jobs. If you don't have real estate, real markets, and nobody knows anymore what anything's worth, the only thing left to drive the financial world is herd mentality. Lemmings have that too. the world is going to regret letting Yellen et al. Destroy the market principle and price discovery. Capitalism as a system cannot possibly work without price discovery. It leads to the many left with nothing but debt and to imploding societies. Oil is the one substance that can make them implode. The American miracle idea of energy independence is fully reliant on a shale patch that went over $100 billion deeper into debt every year for years, running just to produce that not-so-miracle. Take away 40% plus of what revenue it did take in, and there is no independence left. All that's left is fracking fluids in your drinking water and a few trillion in debt that the big kahuna lenders will seek to unload upon the real economy. Those box office and holiday sales numbers I mentioned just now are only the first red flag for where we are going. They're joined by the snap elections in Greece, spun, of course, by Brussels and Japan. Most of all, look at the trend in a wider context. This means a massive amount of increased trouble for the 95% of people who live in the real economy. There's nobody left to protect them from anything at all that goes on. They've been sold out to the highest bidder and the lowest common denominator. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I think we're going to leave it there. It's been a very harrowing show, I am sure you would all agree. But this is the first of many, and things are going to get a lot worse from here on out. All the things I've mentioned are going to come in spades, and there will be no stopping them. No QE to save you and help you out. It's all over, ladies and gentlemen. Get ready. It's going to be a very, very, very rough ride. All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, that's it for today. That's Richard Martin here. I wish you a wonderful week ahead. I will, of course, as always, be back on Friday. And until then, have a good week. Take care. Bye-bye.